welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who chugs martinis, sips gasoline, and just can't find any water. It's Sean Alvishire.
How's it going today, Mark?
Oh, I'm living a dream. Thanks for coming on here.
Yes, I'm very excited. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so this is a very humbling honor for me.
Yeah, and how, like, all that gasoline you've been sipping, how you feeling?
Pretty good. You've been pumping it in me for the last 4 days, so, you know, I'm developing a tolerance.
Good. So, if you haven't heard our podcast before, we've done a Bond podcast. And I think in our first 20, we did one.
Mm-hmm.
But Sean and I have been talking about this movie that we're talking about, Quantum of Solace, probably going on 8 years now, because we're both big James Bond fans. And so I have a thing where I think Quantum of Solace is the worst Bond movie ever made. I guess I'll say it's my least favorite. How's that sound? Because it's not the worst Bond film ever made.
Bond films are personal to everybody, so it could technically be both. You could feel it's the worst, and the one you least like at the same, at least entertaining at the same time, too.
I mean, like, with these Bond movies, it's kind of like, which was your first? You know, which was, you know, your second? What did you go back? So, for me, my favorite's GoldenEye. What's your favorite Bond?
Well, the first, my favorite or first?
What's your first that you watched?
The first movie I saw was A View to a Kill. That was my first Bond movie, and I was hooked. And I think anyone that is a connoisseur of Bond movies knows A View to a Kill would not be ranked in any of the top five, but it just captured my sense of global adventurism.
I mean, starts off in the Eiffel Tower, right?
Starts out in the Eiffel Tower. Well, it actually starts out in the Antarctic, but you know, and that's when, you know, the infamous Beach Boys, California Girls, you know, snow ski song, you know, bursts out. And then it goes from there, then it goes to the countryside of France, and then eventually ends up in Silicon Valley in San Francisco. But as a, 13, 14, just like, it was just the idea of this guy, you know, this bachelor, and he was just super cool, even if it was a 90-year-old Roger Moore, you know, traipsing around the globe, and, you know, it caught everything that a movie is supposed to do, especially when you're young.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it just, yeah.
GoldenEye blew my mind.
We've had this conversation.
When I was 14, because I hadn't watched Bond films, really, because my parents weren't into it, and I was more, you know, when I watched, I did the Columbia House thing, but I could just get my hands on what was that Blockbuster, the newer stuff. So when I saw Bond in 96, then you play the video game, GoldenEye, I was just jumping off skyscrapers. He was being lectured about drinking too much and letting women die. I didn't even know what any of that meant. I was just seeing tanks fly around and Xenia on the top and, you know, great fight scenes. Sean Bean, probably my favorite Bond villain, 006. Alex Trevelyan.
Trevelyan.
I mean, what? It was awesome.
And I would argue in GoldenEye, I think if you rank the top 10 Bond girls, I think two of the top 10 come from GoldenEye.
Yeah, Isabella Scorv.
Who is so underrated. She's so underrated. Like, I thought that movie was going to make her a global superstar. Mm-hmm. And it actually, Famke Janssen was the one that kind of ended up having a very storied career with the X-Men and everything. But
I guess she had the straight man role. And then, you know, Famke was Xenia on the top. Like, you remember that.
Right. You know, and the way she killed people and everything.
I mean, she was good, too, though, Isabella. She was a good she wasn't just the innocent bystander. She was running all over the place, you know. Like,
she was a computer programmer, and you know, and she sold it. You know, unlike, you know, Denise Richards as a, you know, nuclear physicist.
I still, if she wasn't in that movie, it would be a good movie.
Yes, she really hurt it.
But what? I guess what you and I are going to talk about today is this movie, man. When I first watched it the first time, Quantum of Solace, I didn't like it because I felt like it was a Bourne film. I don't know why I felt that, but I watched it. Then I watched it a second time because Meg, for the wedding, Sean's my brother-in-law, by the way, we watched the entire box set. She got that I asked for it for my wedding. You know, that's a me move. Watched through the whole thing, watched it again. I'm like, this is not a movie. And then in preparation for this, I'm trying to have an open brain for it, but watched it again. I'm like, I feel like but we have to give it credit because it did take place during the writer's strike. Paul Haggis had to turn in a draft, I think, 2 hours before the deadline. So they had a first draft. Mark Forster, he hadn't directed World War Z yet. He was known for, like, Finding Neverland, Monsters Ball, those kind of, like, little indies.
Right.
And he definitely brought that sensibility to this movie, which I think kind of hurts. You know, in this movie, they did action scenes around earth, wind, water, earth, air, and fire. Did you know he wanted to have those four action scenes?
I didn't know that was a dynamic to his vision. I did not know that. Now, when you say that now, I see it.
Yeah.
But that is not something I knew that was a vision of Mark Forster's.
Isn't that crazy?
That's actually kind of cool.
What? So you have the air, you have the cargo airplane.
You're making, you know, my argument for me. Continue.
No, but see, I think that's, I don't know. But see, for me, like, he just went in with these ideas and then kind of like, and then without the script, it just felt like a bunch of different things plugged together that like weren't necessary. Like, they didn't really necessarily need a lot of these action scenes. Like the one on the boat in this movie, he's just riding a boat around in a circle, and then he kind of lands at the same place. I don't know.
As we discussed doing this podcast, I sent you a text months ago, and my argument wasn't, which I think you kind of...
I love it.
Yeah, you loved it. What I said was, I go, my argument is, of the 24 Bond films that have been made, Quantum of Solace always ends up between 21 and 24. And my argument is it's more in the middle. And what I said to you was this podcast was at least my argument that it's not awful. It's merely mediocre.
Yeah.
And so to that point, I think what you were saying is true. I'm not arguing that it feels almost like a series of mini movies with horrible transitions. And the transitions are important because the first time I saw the movie, I remember they're after a really cool opening. I think that was one of the
chase in Italy.
Yeah, through the horse races through Siena, Italy, and then it's a direct sequel. So there was a lot of, and it was coming off Casino Royale, which I feel affects people's mental thought process when it comes to this movie, because Casino Royale almost set this new level of excellence for the series that QOS was could not meet. It could not meet the expectations, so therefore that hurt it too, I think, a little bit. And then it ended up being a sandwich movie, which is, it ended up between Skyfall and Casino Royale, so then it kind of gets lost in there too, I think, in people's minds. But once that ends and you're like, okay, this is cool, and then Mr. White disappears, you know, we got people everywhere, and you know, and then all of a sudden you're like in Haiti.
Yeah.
And you're like, the first time you see the movie, you're like, okay, why are we here?
Yeah.
So I don't argue that there are transitional problems, not even that one, throughout the movie. Then you kind of buy into the next section. You're like, okay, this is kind of, okay, we're getting there. And then, okay, now we're somewhere else. You're like, okay, why did we go here now? You know, so there are some definite flaws in the movie. But I feel from start to finish, upon rewatching, it'll hold up better than some of the other Bond movies, which is why I think it'll maybe end up in my pantheon probably around 16, you know, as we rank. But yeah, your arguments are very, I think, well thought out, because there are problems with it.
And I guess, you know, if you listen to the podcast, I had a buddy come on and we talked about Ready to Rumble, and I tried to get him to say positive things about it. So we're not trying to bag on this movie, but I also read these reviews where, like, it's not a Bourne movie, it's not this, and people really take the easy route on it. And I think, I guess, the more I researched this movie, the more I realized how it kind of went wrong. I mean, they were writing the script on set.
Right.
Daniel Craig said he was writing lines. He's like, I don't want to write lines. I'm an actor. Mark Forster, the next massive movie he directed, World War Z, he kind of got pulled from, and they did massive reshoots on that. So part of me wonders if he's better with, like, the art house type vibe, and you had all these ideas. Also, did you know that this movie, I never remember this. They go from Italy to Haiti, to Austria, to Italy, to Bolivia, and then to Russia.
Right.
Does it feel like they go? I just felt like they were in Haiti the whole time the first time I watched it. Or, you know what I mean? Like, one area.
Right. You know, they go to, well,
or South America, maybe. Like, or, you know,
yeah,
thereabouts.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, License to Kill when they go to Isthmus City, and it's just like this generic Panamanian town that could be anywhere in Central or South America. You do kind of get that sense of, okay, we're in a Hispanic country that could be anywhere South America, Central America. They did kind of gloss over where they were a little bit. But, you know, I remember being really, you know, when you think of Bond movies, you think of Montenegro, you think of Paris, you think of Tokyo, you think of Macau.
Fargo.
Port-au-Prince doesn't, you know, grab at you, but you've got to remember what this movie was about. This was the kind of his descent into 007 as a hard boiled killer. In retrospect, looking back at it over time, there was a purpose to put them in these kind of drab locales, because I think that's what they were trying to encapture was after Vesper Lynn dies at the end of Casino Royale, they wanted to take him into, they didn't want the next one to be glamorous. But a lot of people obviously are like, wait a minute, that's not a Bond movie. Like, why are we in Haiti? We should be in Vegas. We should be in London. We should be, you know, in cool, amazing places like we were in Casino Royale. So I think what they were trying to do with the movie fit what they were trying to do with Bond, but I don't know from an audience standpoint, when audiences watched it, I think they were like, wait a minute, this isn't a Bond movie. Like, what, we're going to Haiti? We're going to Bolivia? Like, what is this?
And actually, that you made a good point. I never thought about that, because I felt like Bond in this movie was just kind of a dickhead. He didn't have any, like, much dialogue. He gets people killed. He takes Matthias with Bolivia. Matthias gets killed. He dumps him in a dumpster. And then he's with...
Mathis,
I'm sorry. And then he's with Strawberry Fields.
Oh, yeah. And Gemma Arterton with her 10-minute, you know. Yeah.
And then she gets killed immediately.
Right. But a nice throwback to Goldfinger with the oil.
I mean, just slicks her in that. And so he's kind of getting people killed and leaving a lot of collateral damage. And M's like, would you stop killing people so I can,
yeah, that was,
know,
like, a theme.
Yeah, like, stop murdering people. So I guess if that's what they were going for. Because in Casino Royale, he showed heart with... Eva Green, like that shower scene when he sits down with her, like he loved her. And like he did show some, he tried to save some people, you know, but it was, so I guess you're right. He tried to become that. But I feel like that took away from the character a little bit for this, because it wasn't so much of an evolution as it just sort of happened after Casino Royale. Does that make sense?
Right. And you have to remember, and it was poorly executed.
Yeah, there
I think
you go.
I think is a way to describe it. But I think what they were trying to do is, what would be the natural place for Bond after
losing Vesper?
Yeah, losing Vesper. Where would he be naturally? You know, where would this pick up? And this movie picks up, you know, almost the next day.
Mm-hmm. Car chase.
And so, where would his mind be in that moment with, you know, being betrayed, but still he, you know, his heart still loved her. So I think they were trying to capture what he would actually be like in that conflict that he was dealing with. And he just, you know, kind of turned it into just being a pure assassin.
Yeah.
But then there's that, you know, that final scene where he doesn't kill the boyfriend, because that's when M asks him, she's like, did you kill him? He goes, no, but we got everything out of him. So that was kind of that, the last scene is him becoming a more thoughtful assassin or something that M wants, just not a cold-blooded killer, which is like she talks to him about in Casino Royale, like anybody can pull a trigger, you know, it's when not to.
License to kill sometimes.
Right.
And I have a question. When Mathis gets killed and he picks him up and throws him in the trash, I feel like he made him more visible because he didn't even cover him up in there.
Right.
So
I just think the scene, if you want to look at it, look, I mean, if you want to like dissect certain things, I would feel.
I was like, just put a
it's
bag
not,
on top
yeah,
of him.
I think it was more.
For the look. Like
the look of how much in that pure moment, humanity was just completely gone. From James Bond. He picked up a body. This was a friend. Threw him in a dumpster. And then when she's like, what are you doing? And he goes, oh, he wouldn't care.
Yeah.
Like, that was, like, I think the nadir of Bond. At that moment, like, he was discarding a body in a dumpster and had zero feeling about it. I think that was the... If you think about it in terms of... Well, the police would have saw it. I mean, look, I mean, a lot of movies, if you get into the actual practicality of things, I mean, you can go down a pretty big rabbit hole.
Well, I guess for that moment. And then she made the comment, too, like you're.
It's another example of, if you really think about it, they're really trying hard to execute something that they just kept missing on. But if you watch it. You know, I'm not encouraging people to, you know, watch a movie you don't like, but the more you spend time on it, you realize, God, this is a much better movie. They just kept, you know, it was almost like a singer just a hair off key. They just kept missing, but their ideas behind it were really good and really, really thoughtful in what they were trying to accomplish, but they just kept missing. And
the writer's strike probably hurt that
right.
a lot.
And you shouldn't have to watch a movie 8 times to, you know, to pick up on things. And you know what I'm saying? So that, you know, and that's a fair, I think that's a fair criticism. But I just, the reason I like it in some respects is I'm such a huge Daniel Craig Bond fan that I gave it, I probably gave it a second, third, fourth, fifth watching, only because I'm such a fan of his and what he's brought to this role that maybe I was a little stubborn with it at first, but it kind of grew on me. And then the more I kept watching, I'm like, God, this is actually a little better than I realized. And that's when you and I got into the conversation. Yeah. And most people have your opinion of the movie. If you look at any reviews, most people haven't given it a second look. Yeah. And the only reason you did is because, you know, our relationship as brother-in-laws are at stake here, you know, over this movie. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I almost it was kind of wild watching this, though, during all the way through.
Yeah.
Because Megan and I plowed through the entire series again, and just this was, I don't know, just, you know what's weird? This is the shortest Bond movie.
Mm-hmm.
This could have been 15, 20 minutes longer.
Yeah, and when does anyone ever say that about a movie?
Get me out of here is what I'm saying most
right.
of the time.
And that's where and I think that's those transition scenes could have given more depth and understanding as to why the whys. I mean, even the Dominic Green's plot to, I mean, you look at climate change today and you think about it, that was a little ahead of its time where, you know, to control the water supplies, it's not as sexy as, you know, a hollowed out volcano and, you know, all the cool other Bond movies. I mean, it's kind of a...
He didn't have a cat.
Right. It's a very realistic and boring, it'd be like another Bond movie trying to control the interstate highway system or something. It'd be like, it's something cool, you know. But in a sense, it's a very interesting and plausible idea that some, you know, high-powered governments would look to in this game of global geopolitical risk. Controlling water is a way to control countries. And it was a very neat idea, you know, with Dominic Green and what they were trying to accomplish.
He's just a kind of a middleman-y, though, and he doesn't have enough time to really be a... Like, I know a lot of Bond... Like, Lashif and Mads Mikkelsen, he just had the teary eye. There wasn't much to him, but I guess he's such a good actor with a good bit, like a good bloody eye.
Right, I mean, that was just such a... So much a more well-developed...
And a good actor.
Yeah, I mean...
So this guy kind of... I don't know, the first time you meet him, he's with Olga Kirilenko. And he killed a geologist, right? Who's hanging out in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then they drive around on boats for a little while. Then he goes to Austria. He just never seemed like a match. Like, I'm not saying a villain has to be a physical match for Bond, but he just seemed like too much of a middleman for me. Does that make sense?
Excuse me. Yes, he is. He was a poorly selected actor for that role.
They wanted to go for a non-threatening
And they got it.
Yeah, they didn't want a bloody-eyed guy. They wanted a guy with no signs of evil, except for when he goes feral at the end.
Right, yeah.
Which I guess when I first watched that and the fight scene between them, I was a little annoyed, but they said he just attacks him like a feral wombat. And then, I guess if you're Bond and a little guy attacks you with a very light-looking axe, like a feral wombat, you're going to be thrown off guard, maybe. Have you ever had an axe swung at you, Sean?
No. I think I would remember that.
You had to think about that for a second.
Yeah, I was like, let's double check. I'm a little older than you.
Does a hatchet count?
Yeah. And, you know, another couple interesting things is that final sequence at that hotel, that's actually from a site selection standpoint, it's actually on some naval base down in Chile. And it's this, I want to say it's like a 3,000 acre, 5,000 acre, 10,000 acre, something like this national military base where they study the stars or whatever, and that hotel is completely powered by solar panels, and so this is where I think they got a little too cute. It's an unbelievable sight. I mean, it really is. It's spectacular visually, the whole nine yards. But again,
they blow it up immediately.
Right. But it's so the Bond people found this unbelievable location, and then it felt like they shoehorned the reason, and they never really explained like why they're in this empty hotel, you know, to do this transaction with this, you know, the new incoming dictator. It's like, why are we here? Why are we at this empty hotel? Visually, I can understand why they did it there, but it, like, in some respects, it's like, it's like this 500 room hotel and it's pretty awesome, but nobody's here. And then obviously, you know, Bond shows up and turns the whole place into a raging inferno. But
in about 3 minutes.
I feel like, yeah, and that's where we get into, here I am, it's almost like you're making the issue why it's better, and I'm just acknowledging.
That's fun. I like that.
Acknowledging just the flaws in it, which was I felt like they found a great location, and then they kind of shoehorned a great location into the story. To your point, the movie could have been 15 minutes longer, little more exposition as to why they're out at this, you know, really cool place to do this transaction. It's never explained.
Mm-mm. Or why they? Well, I know that they go to Austria, but that's an incredibly expensive scene in Austria with all the extras.
At the Tosca Opera, that's a great scene.
Yeah, but the building is beautiful. Like the setup. And so I wonder if this movie, since they only had a first draft, and then he wanted to do the action scenes on Earth, Wind, you know, do you remember the 21st night of December and Fire? Sorry, that's a, you know, I thought that was September for a long time. Do you remember the 21st night of September? But isn't it December? Earth, Wind, and Fire?
I thought it was December.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. I also thought that, oh, what a night. I always thought it was late September back in 63, but it's December.
That's December.
I always think everything's September.
Yeah, well, yeah, it started school year, so.
Yeah, you're right. But like, so I wonder if they went into it with ideas, a brief script, and then I want to air fight, and I want to fight in the air, I want to fight on the water. And so you just have these ideas, and then they had to shoehorn. Because, I mean, this movie happens fast. So they wanted to fit all this stuff in, but then it had to have the story to really explain a lot of it.
Right. That's the transitions, I feel, are the true weakness of the movie, because it really, the audience doesn't know why we go from point A to point B. Whereas in Casino Royale, in Skyfall, and even in Spectre to some extent, you at least have an idea of why Bond is going from place to place to place. In Quantum of Solace, it feels like four really good mini-movies and very weak transitions between the four mini-movies. And I think that's where people get lost and then they lose interest. And then it's like, and if you think about it, if you really don't know why we're here, you kind of get to the end and then, you know, it's like, why does this fight at the end of the movie matter to me as an audience member? Because, and I feel that's where the movie lags. But again, it's like I say, I mean, our conversation is in the pantheon of only Bond movies, should it be in the 20s? And my argument is that there are other movies I feel that have not shown the great test of time. And QOS will move up. Kind of like, look, I mean, you know, we talked about this prior to the pod. Her Majesty's Secret Service was reviled when it came out. Reviled. And any list today shows it in the top 10.
It's in my top five.
It's mine too.
Yeah.
I think it by far has the best ending, most meaningful ending.
It's aged really well.
And George Lazenby has really kind of become a cult hero Bond, you know, in his.
We showed emotion and he cried at the end.
Yeah.
And like, that was.
And. But my point is, you know, that movie has grown in the test of time, even in amongst Bond fans and even critics. And then there's others that I think that people generally thought were the best great Bonds that I think have, you know, shown some wear on the edges over the course of time. But that doesn't mean an old movie is like From Russia with Love is arguably the best movie ever made.
That's my favorite.
And that was the second movie they ever made.
Yeah.
So just because it's old doesn't mean it can't withstand the test of time. You know, everybody goes, to my mind, they always go to Goldfinger, and I just still have a problem with the Fort Knox scene.
Yeah.
It's just so hokey.
So, what do you think about this? So, some movies, Quantum of Solace isn't going to age poorly, but it's not going to age really well. So, while other Bonds are aging poorly, it kind of moves up in the list.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like, there's nothing truly offensive about it.
The more you watch it, it becomes a more entertaining film. And if you watch it within context of the four Bond movies, it really carries the arc of Bond. And of course, Craig will have his final Bond, you know, at the end of next year. I feel that that's a Quantum of Solace. It comes out a little bit when you look at it in that story arc of Daniel Craig's five movies, which when you think about it, they never really did that with any other actor.
Yeah.
Daniel Craig's the only actor where they really tied all the movies together in one singular arc, where most other Bond movies, almost all of them, are singular entries.
Yeah.
Except for on Her Majesty's Secret Service, obviously. But then in the next movie after, it's like it never happened.
Doesn't Connery stuff Blofeld into a chimney or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. And well, the following one was Diamonds Are Forever.
Got it.
And which was a weak entry by far. And, you know, Connery did it for admittedly to this day, he said he did it for the money. And, you know, the Roger Moore era started. So, but look, I'm a guy that thinks Timothy Dalton gets kicked to the curb too easily. I really thought that License to Kill, I thought it was a great movie, but I feel like Dalton, you mean some people, if they're not like true like Bond aficionados, they almost forget Timothy Dalton made two movies. But then he got the writer's strike, he made two movies, and then he got caught up in, or not the writer's strike, that was when United Artists.
The lawsuit.
And there was about a 4-year delay because they didn't know who would be able to produce the movies because there was a fight over the rights. And then obviously he felt he outgrew the role. And that's when Pierce Brosnan, who ironically lost to Timothy Dalton the first go around, got his shot at Goldeneye,
he was great in Goldeneye. I loved his arc.
Goldeneye's a great, great. The problem with Brosnan is he's so re-energized the series that they got kind of caught up in that 90s bigger, better, CGI, crazier, and, you know, then it just, you know, you throw Die Another Day, and it's just, I can't even comprehend people watching Die Another Day and watching Quantum of Solace and, like, looking me straight in the face and telling me Die Another Day was better. It's just so bad on so many levels. It's just, ugh.
I could do it, because... But my argument is, like, it's just so bad in moments that I love it. Like, it's
that's the argument.
I think it has more personality than this movie does. Because if you think about this, too, in this movie, Bond's prior, they really use their locations to their advantage. So think about Spectre. When they're going to Blofeld's lab, they have that great scene where Leah and Craig are just standing there looking amazing in their outfits. Like, they use the locations really well. You think about, I mean, even with Die Another Day at the end of the ice place, like they built action scenes around that, and so you always feel like when he was in the Alps they built around that, or then the desert, like they really use their locations well. But this movie just kind of shoot, like there's no, you know what I mean, they don't use their locations to the best of their abilities in this either. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think we touched on it right at the beginning. A lot of people, when he goes to Haiti, he's in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, he's in Bolivia, or as we like to talk about, generic Central American, South American country. Yeah, a lot of people, when they see Quantum of Solace, are like, I come to Bond movies to see Paris. I come to see Montenegro, Macau. I come to see... What the hell is this?
At least spend more time in Haiti, because that could be interesting. Yeah. Like, spend 15 more minutes there.
Yeah.
Like, hanging out with Olga, or Camille. Camille, we haven't even talked about her yet.
And she's underrated.
She's awesome.
She's great in the movie.
I feel bad for her in this movie, because in the beginning, she has a horrible plan. Like, she got kidnapped by a general, and he's going to do horrible things to her, but she has a gun with her, and she's going to shoot him. I mean, there's a lot that has to happen. But then Bond shows up and, like, wrecks her plan, the poor lady. And then he's like, I'm saving you. And she's like, what? Like, I don't know. I like that she was on her own mission. I like that at the end, he kisses her, and she's just like, yeah, whatever. Like, she looks at him like, yeah, whatever. Like, it's cool. And then, like, she goes away.
Oh,
like,
I love the
fact. That
was
really refreshing.
Well, the connection there was more, the connection between Camille and Bond in the movie was that they were so similar. They were at their...
Kind of broken.
Broken from life.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that had occurred to them in life, that they were down onto that, you know, I like to call it your final, you know, tensile string. You know, you're just, like, one away from, like, you know... kissing the world goodbye, and they were both brought to each other, and they were both in the same mental
mindset. Yeah, because her family was murdered. She just wants revenge. He wants revenge.
Right.
And then he's angry about other things, so he's attacking that because of the organization.
Right.
But I like, on the boat chase, I like when she levels that dude with an oar. Like, she's pulling her, like, she's like, duck, and like, driving, like, that was cool. Like, I wanted more of her.
Yeah.
And then they left her, and they went to, like, what, Austria, and then he went to, what, Italy. And then they find her again in Bolivia. But I was like, I didn't want to leave that character. I liked her so much. So I wonder if there were rewrites or something that happened that kept her from being in it more.
Maybe. Yeah. And it's a little strange. Yeah, there's that he leaves and then he comes back and he's able to kind of reconnect with her.
I like how she shows up, though. She, like, costs him millions of dollars.
Yeah.
That's gangster.
Yeah, yeah. She has the force of nature and wherewithal to do what she wants to do, but she doesn't have the skill set, yeah, as you pointed out. You know, it's hard, you know, it's hard to...
She doesn't have...
believe that she's going to get on that, you know, like, you know, it's her versus... I guess the thought process was... Well, yeah, that's the only way I could figure it out, that she didn't care about dying whenever the general was going to, you know, decide to have his way with her. That's
that dude
when,
was so gross.
Yeah, and it was, you know, like I said, I just feel like they missed... They're trying to play a movie in C, and they were like, B flat. They were just missing... Their intent was about as good as any Bond movie. They just, for, you know, reasons maybe that were confounding, that were exterior to the movie, like the writer's strike and other things that confounded the movie, and they just had to get it out by a certain date, they just kept missing on the connections, and it's what will always hold the movie back.
Have you ever watched a Bond movie and you've liked the side character more? Like, I liked her more than Bond. I understood his mission on this. But,
oh, yeah, Rosamund Pike.
Yeah, oh, yeah, she was awesome in that, in Die Another Day. But in this one, I liked that she got into this place on her own, cost him millions. She got in her place to do this, like, dubious methods, but then she just sort of, like, hung in there. So Bond has the backing of the government. He has all this money. He's charming. You know, he can, you know, woo Jim Arterton in no time. You know, beat up anybody, kill anybody, walk away from it. And here's this lady that's, like, almost equal with him, with none of his... You know, flights.
Skill set.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, she couldn't,
or
she couldn't buy
bandwidth. Yeah.
She couldn't buy six Vester martinis on an airplane.
Right.
Because she probably doesn't have the money for it. So I liked, I don't know, I found myself watching this movie again. And I think that's bad in a Bond movie. We're like, give me more of her. Like, I really like that character.
It's so interesting. Like, when you talk to people about Bond movies and they'll sit there and go, what's your favorite movie? And a lot of times they have favorite scenes from Bond movies. But then you go, well, is that your favorite movie? And they're like, well, I loved this character, or I loved, you know, I love this, or I love that, but like the whole movie. And I think that's where Quantum of Solace moves up, because I feel like there's a lot of coolness in other movies, but in totality, Quantum of Solace, while missing some beats, has a pretty good story from start to finish. A lot of the Bond movies, you know, you just feel that the thumb on the scale from the studio. Like we mentioned, you know, Moonraker. Moonraker's a pretty good movie for about 2/3 of the way through. And then they take an iconic villain and turn him into a comic book character at
Jaws.
The end. Yeah. Then they're shooting lasers off in space. And I mean, it just, nothing made sense. I mean, it was so hokey. And you're like, how can you take a movie that's this good for, you know, 90 minutes and just ruin it in the final 30. And so when you talk Quantum of Solace, I feel like, it misses a beat here, it misses a beat there, it misses a beat there. But it, in totality, it's a pretty good story, and it really attempts to create more depth into who Bond is. Now, it's a product of its time.
Yeah.
You know, we want different things from our movies now. You know, we don't want Adam West Batman anymore. We want Christian Bale Batman now.
Yeah.
So it's a product of our times, too. But, you know, some of those, oh, my God, it's almost painful sometimes when you, like, watch some of those older Bond movies. It's just that, you know, that you can just feel the studio thumb in some of them.
Sean Connery in Asian Face.
Yeah, not good. Not good.
And
you
so,
know.
But you know what could be good about this movie is there isn't a gimmick. Like, there's no underwater fights. There's no epic underwater battles. There's no Moonraker. There's no ice castles.
Right.
There's no facial reconstruction. You know, this one guy was now another guy because he had a surgery.
Yeah, there's no 10-minute fencing scene and Madonna is the, you know, running the fencing studio. You know, I mean, those kind of gimmicks are not in Quantum of Solace.
Yeah. So I wonder if you've watched all of them in a row, then you watch this one, it sticks out like a sore thumb and maybe you reject it a little bit. Just because...
Oh, it does not feel... And to your point, you started this off. I think you made a very good point, and it's true. The Bourne movies...
Oh, yeah.
It truly... You talk about taking space in the broccoli's head. There is no doubt that the Bourne movies took up a couple floors in Albert Wilson and Barbara Broccoli's head when this movie came out. And the quick edits, the distorted edits, and those sort of things, they were definitely pulled from the Bourne Identity. Mm-hmm. And they wanted, and it's like, what can make that somewhat frustrating is, why are you so worked up about the Bourne movies when you're coming off Casino Royale, which I think many people would argue with the new Academy Award with 10 pictures.
It would have made it.
It would have made it.
Should have made it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, that would be one of those, like, you know, articles that you write, which is, you know, greatest movies that, due to politics, didn't, you know, if it didn't get nominated, you know, why it should have and how politics kept it out, you know, that sort of thing. Why were Barbara Broccoli and Albert Wilson so caught up in the Bourne series when they just came off making quite possibly the most perfect Bond movie ever made? So what was, but, you know, hey, you and I are producing, half $1 billion movie. So who knows what pressures they were under.
I wrote here, I kept waiting for a scene that lasted 2 seconds. Just the cut in the beginning. So the opening scene of Quantum of Solace, or one of the open scenes, is just like probably a helicopter shot closing in a beautiful highway in Italy.
It's the opening shot.
Yeah, opening shot. So it's like 10 seconds long, and you're like, this is really nice. I kind of wrote, I wish I would just watch this instead, because it's a beautiful shot of the water leading into a really nice mountain with a beautiful road. I'm like, this is great. And all of a sudden, boom, boom, cut. Like, I like some of the gags that they had in there with the car stunts, but, and I guess with a two-lane tunnel, you got to cut quick. But there was a scene where he kind of drove off into a construction site for a second. I was like, yeah, this one's great. And then the scene's over. And then the fight scene with the guy, the bodyguard of M, who tries to kill M. That was a Bourne fight, if I'd ever seen one.
Sure.
The fight I like the most is when he gets to Haiti. And he fights the guy that looks exactly like him. And he slams him through the glass window. Then he's all cut up. That was the Bond I love from Casino Royale, like the wrecking ball who runs through a wall.
And he gets hurt.
Yeah. I wrote an article, my favorite action moments of this century, and that's in there in Casino Royale, where the guy jumps over the door and he runs through it. Like, not only does that say this is a new Bond, but he's a tanker of a man. And that's what I like, the longer takes. But, you know, Martin Campbell, the director, probably has more experience than Mark Forster did.
You know, it's easy for people... I mean, you and I have never directed, you know, big budget movies or anything, but I can see not trusting it. And Martin Campbell, you know, he trusted himself to let those action scenes play, let those shots run just a hair longer. Well, even in the Bourne movies, they let them run a little longer because you can comprehend.
Yeah, you
the
know
fight
what's going
scenes.
On. Yeah,
they definitely were probably a half second too quick on some of the edits. Maybe they were just like, we're gonna out Bourne. I don't know, but
how fast are their cuts? We'll make ours faster.
Yeah, and it's still not terrible, but it's, you know, in that fight scene on the, you know, when they fall through. I mean, it's bad CGI when they fall down through the glass ceiling. But then on all the what do you call it? The
scaffolding.
That was
he's hanging upside down.
And, you know, and the way they would shoot it upside down with the gun, and it gave you Bond's view. That was a pretty well executed, fight sequence. So, like I said, there's just cool things about it. I mean, I think the Tosca opera scene is completely well done.
I like the detective work in that. He gets the earpiece. Even M does some detective work in this, which I kind of like.
Well, one scene, the transition going into Haiti comes off of the dollar bills. And my problem with that scene is it should have been longer because it was actually... It's a great scene. She's like, impress me. Yeah. But that scene is literally like 3 minutes long, and it's the sole reason he goes to Haiti. But the first time you see it, it happens so fast, you don't even pick up on what that conversation was. You just, okay, they're looking at money.
That dude was a boss, too, because she's like, we're busy. We don't have time for this. Impress me. And then the dude really impresses her.
But they... Like, trust it. Give it a hair more time and let the audience absorb it. I remember, like, the third time I watched it, I put the movie on closed captions just so I could read the dialogue because it was so fast. And this is a real, if you're going to do a short scene like that, this is like a personal pet peeve. Don't cut away from the people talking. because I feel like it in a longer scene you can do it. If the audio is quality, you can show the reaction while someone is speaking. If you're gonna have a quick scene, you can't have it. You can't have everything, and so it's hard to already follow that scene, and then you're not even seeing some of the people talk, so you can't even like follow their lips a little bit. I mean, it helps your eyes, the senses absorb a scene. And you watch it in closed captions, you're like, wow, this is a really cool scene.
This guy's great.
This is great. But I mean,
he should have been given a shot where he's just gloating. They walk out and he just starts dancing.
Yeah, or something.
Because he impressed them and they were skeptical. And that's smart. That's detective work. I don't know if people say they want that from their Batman. But I kind of like that from Bond, too. Like, just, you know, pump the pavement, you know?
I've read the books, and I mean, he's basically a detective in the books.
Oh.
And, you know, when you read the old Ian Fleming, you know, books, and, you know, if you look back at the old ones, Dr. No, Rush from Rush for Love, he's doing more, detective work. But then, you know, it's like anything, you know, it becomes a franchise, and then you want to get bigger, better, and, you know, that sort of thing. So, but... Yeah, I agree. They're like you said. They're start to finish. It's a good quality movie. It's not great. I'm not here to make that argument. I just think it kind of gets shortchanged for a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with the movie, and then it's just a little off key. So if you're already in a mindset of all the Daniel Craig movies, Quantum of Solace is terrible. You know, you're already in a mindset of it's bad. And then when you watch it, unless you just commit to looking at it in a different light, which you did, you can see, like, you know, they're really trying to accomplish something here, but there were clearly forces that people don't see that affect the movie. I mean,
totally agree.
We can have this conversation about a lot of movies. I mean, I don't want to go down a non sequitur rabbit hole here, but
do it.
People hate Godfather 3, and they should. But what people don't know was Robert Duvall had committed to that movie, and then at the last minute bailed because he tried to hold the studio hostage for more money. And Coppola only had 6 weeks to deliver a screenplay.
Yep.
And then Winona Ryder backed out. And he had,
yep.
So everyone gets all up on, you know, for obviously putting in his daughter, but the reason the daughter, it wasn't his plan to put her in there. But
they had Pacino. You can't knock schedules back. Once you have a movie of this size, you can't, guys, hey, Pacino, we're stopping filming for 6 weeks while I find an actress. Pacino's like, ugh. Yeah.
So Godfather 3, it fairly gets knocked for being a poor third movie, but people just look at the movie thinking...
Oh, Coppola, Sophia.
Yeah, everything is just equal, and they had all the time in the world to come up with this screenplay, and they had all the time in the world, and everyone had all the time in the world. Sometimes, and you, because you've worked in the industry, you've taught me this a lot, sometimes things have to be hastily written. And so that's where Quantum of Solace suffered, the writer's strike and all these other things, where I feel like when you watch it and you really give it a shot, maybe even watch it with closed captions, you go... Man, there's a heartbeat of a really good movie here that they just, you know, it's almost like a hanging curveball. Yeah. You just, you know, they just missed. And it's a good movie. I think it'll grow. I mean, I've already seen articles on the internet where people have actually given it a second.
Yeah, Slash Film just wrote an article about it, praising it.
Yeah, it's better than you think.
But it's in the phase right now, it's unpopular opinion. So they're not just going like, get over yourselves, this is a good movie. They're just saying, I have an unpopular opinion to share. It was a good article.
Yeah.
But everything they said that they loved it, I was like,
And this isn't a contrarian opinion. I'm not, you know, you and I don't have this. You know, I genuinely like it. Not love it, like it. And I'm not being contrarian for contrarian's sake. That's the purpose of the pod.
Well, no, you actually have data or like, you know, you have reasons, not just because.
And I mean, I even said something to you the other day that, you know, I thought you were going to, you know, pour me another glass of whiskey when I said I actually prefer Quantum of Solace to Spectre, and you just like were like, okay, my brother-in-law,
he's losing his mind.
We might need to, you know, call in some folks and give him some help, and you know, but
all right. So how about this? You and I, we're gonna scream at each other off air for a few minutes. We're gonna go to break, and when we come back, you and I have settled the dust. It might be a year has passed because we got into such a bad argument that, you know,
I can feel it building.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're both ready to scream at each other. So when we get back, we'll talk about more Quantum of Solace. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. That was disappointing. We didn't even argue. We just kind of talked it out, and then we had another whiskey, and now we're back. It's been like 10 minutes.
Yeah, it was... You're coming to my side. I feel like this is like turning into a Star Wars kind of, you know, I'm moving you from the dark side to the light.
No! And I hate that I can't scream about movies anymore. Isn't that bad?
Well, you're maturing.
You don't agree with me?
Yeah.
I'm going to yell at you.
Yeah, you're maturing. You're growing older.
You know, Tarantino wouldn't date women if they didn't like Rio Bravo. But Rio Bravo is a 2.5-hour hangout film with a bunch of dudes chilling. Like, I mean, people don't have to love that movie, but he would dump them.
Really?
Yeah. If you don't like Rio Bravo. What's a really weird movie, Sean, that's like, you don't like Godfather? I can't believe you. You don't like Tremors 4? Right? What's like...
Yeah. What, like, that would be interesting. Like, yeah, not like Casablanca or something like mainstream. Like, something that would... Like yeah, what would be like a...
Baby's Day Out.
Like... What do you mean you don't like UHF?
Yeah.
That's like one of the iconic movies. I can't date a woman who doesn't like, you know, how do you not like, you know, Michael Richards' Betrayal? You know, like, yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, like, yeah. You'd have some woman like, yeah, I don't want to date you either, you know, buddy.
Wait, you like Dunstan Checks In? We're going to watch this movie together and I'm going to see what you think.
You didn't buy into the... arc in Brewster's Millions when, you know,
Listen, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead is a classic. Man, I hated that movie. And I hated that Pool Hall Junkies movie that was a ripoff of Pulp Fiction about 8 years too late.
I didn't see that one.
It made me,
you're not encouraging me to go see it either.
I've never been angry during a movie, but watching this movie, I just was so mad because it had no reason to exist other than being a Pulp Fiction knockoff that wasn't as good.
Well,
it wasn't even trying to be its own thing. It was just trying to be a Pulp Fiction knockoff.
Yeah, there's a lot of movies like
that. I guess it got made.
Yeah.
I mean, the Great Train Robbery was remade a year later. So, I mean, it's all relative.
Yeah. I mean, if someone thinks there's money in it...
They're making it.
Yeah. I mean, but then look at the flip side. I mean, it was... Deadpool took, you know, a viral internet campaign because nobody believed in it. And it, you know, became a movie sensation.
$600 million. The second one made like $750 million. R-rated.
Right.
Imagine if it was PG-13.
Yeah.
Aquaman's already passed 800 million.
Well, John Kennedy once said that success has a million fathers and defeat is an orphan. You know, after the fact, there's a lot of people taking credit for Deadpool when the simple fact of the matter of it was the director and Ryan Reynolds that just pushed and pushed and pushed.
Yeah, and they leaked in quotation marks.
Right.
The video.
Right. So, but now there's a lot of people, I'm sure, in Hollywood taking full credit for Deadpool.
Some guy's drinking a vodka right now going, that was me.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So anyway.
All right. So I have two questions for you before we move on. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching Quantum of Solace, and there's a scene where he's walking into a scene in, I think, London, and he walks by an extra, just a security guard extra, and they kind of look at each other with negative, they kind of eyeball each other, and then Bond walks into a room. The guy says nothing. So I was wondering, if you could be an extra in a Bond movie, what kind of role would you want? So no lines, so you're just someone on the set. Like, you could be a crony in an orange hat who gets blown up by a lava burst. You could be... You know, a crony who gets, you know, whatever. You could be a cop. You could be a tourist somewhere that gets bumped into and you fall on the ground. Like, what would be your dream extra role on a Bond film?
I think this would count. I would like to be an extra whenever they do a gambling scene.
Oh, because you'd be there for a long time.
So those men or women are just sitting at the baccarat table or they're at the... Well, not the poker scene in that. That's a major set piece. Yeah. So those are actual actors. But one of the more innocuous scenes, like when Bond comes in and Xenia Onatopp is there playing baccarat, or you know,
and Dr. No,
right? One of those sequences where he is gambling, but the gambling isn't a centerpiece to the plot. It's just a cool. Yeah. Badass background, just to show Bond, you know, winning a
game. He hits on 19 or
right,
something.
Right, yeah, exactly. But to be at the table with the sexual tension that always goes on in those scenes or whatever, I would want to be, because you'd get to be in a tuxedo, you would be like in the the single greatest casino on the planet at the time, what people envision that. So if I could choose, that would be the role I would want to have. And of course, I would have some insanely beautiful date sitting next to me in some, like, you know, $100,000 gown, you know, because that's how you go to the casino. Yeah. You know, when you go to Vegas, people think it's just a bunch of old people with cigarettes hanging from. No, everyone's in like $100,000 dresses and tuxes walking around.
Yeah, I wear Armani when I go to Vegas.
Absolutely.
While I'm eating my $7 steak dinner. Like, for me, I would want to be. All right, so I've been in my extra roles, I've had to take James Purefoy away. I was a cop who dragged James Purefoy away in The Following.
Underrated role, if I could throw in a 2 cents for you.
I was an FBI spook or some kind of spook who dragged Omar Epps away. So I've dragged two big actors out of rooms before. So I would want to be, so he goes to like Blofeld because I can be next to Christoph Waltz, put me in a nice like white outfit. Someone drugs Bond, I catch him. Or another two of us catch him and we just drag him away.
That'd be good.
Because then I could carry on my goon role and I could say Agent Bluesteel is just bouncing around from, you know, place to place. He's really working his way up from being a prison security guard to a spook to working for Blofeld. Because you got to be a trusted guy. If you work for Blofeld, and you and another guy are trusted to carry Bond away. That's, Blofeld knows your name.
Right.
Like, you're not a henchman too. You're
right.
Rick.
You might be on the Christmas card list.
Yeah, cat with the little Christmas outfits.
Yeah, you might be getting invited to the Blofeld Christmas party at the end of the year because you are on a, he knows your name.
Yeah, and you're trusted. Like, right. He's not just like, who are those two guys that drag Bond away? And they're not going to go like, hey, this is a big place. Where do we put them?
Yeah.
Like, where's Bond? We put him in the janitor closet. Why? Well, we couldn't find a torture room.
Yeah.
It's actually more secure. Like, your torture room,
everyone gets out of that.
There's eight gas tanks. Like, and there's sharks, like, that he could escape from. We put him in a locked janitor closet with no vents. We know this because we're...
Right. Oh, golly.
They still kill you. Like, you did the right thing by putting him in a janitor closet. But I just want to be the guy that kind of glowers. I try to glower, but I'm not good at it, so I look like I'm doing Bluesteel. And then I just catch him, and I drag him away. That'd be my ideal role.
Well, and the audience needs to know that you're coming in about at 6'3", and you kind of got the look of the guy that could be, you know, Rick. The guy that would be not henchman number one, but, you know, the next guy down, but
I'm
still...
I'm not Red Grant.
Right, but you're the next guy where Blofeld or, you know, Sean Bean would know your name.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That sort of thing. You know, Alex Trevelyan would know you.
Like in Hot Shots Part 2, when they bring in Topper Harley, they're like, you're the best of what's left. So after Red Grant gets wiped out, Xenia on the top, all the big, let's say 10 henchmen get wiped out. They're like, where's Rick? He's pretty good. Right?
Yeah, you wonder about you'd have to think, like, if you decide to do that as a career path, you'd, unlike in other worlds where it could take you 25 years to, you know, to reach, to become a senior vice president or something to that effect, you would have to think it's not a bad, if you're looking for like an accelerated, you know, opportunities to get to the top of the, you know, organizational chart, it's not a bad career path.
I mean, it's a couple of years because you have agents, right? And at least so 007, right? Let's say there's 40. There can't be 40 double O's.
No.
but let's say there's 100 agents, right? And if you kill an agent, he gets at least 5 henchmen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to, like, so let's say over the course of a year, you get 5 agents. He takes out about 40 henchmen. So you're moving up the queue pretty quick. Like, if you start at number 100, you're going to make it to number 6 within 3, 4, 5 years, depending on how good the guy is.
And any... If within the organization there is some sort of major conflict, you could move up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, the only downside is if you're henchman number 100, you're going to be like on the front line. So you got to survive. That's the only downside. You have to survive being fodder. So I feel like Red Grant, he survived.
Yeah,
you know,
he made it through the snowmobile chases.
Right. It's kind of like,
the,
you know,
skiing chases.
It's kind of like Maximus. You know, he's the general, but he's out there fighting like with all the infantry guys, too. The reason he's the general is because, well, geez, man, I feel like he just survived more battles than everybody else, you know. He's the general, so.
Who's been here the longest?
Right.
How long? 3 weeks? Oh, you're the general.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like that's the only downside being a henchman number 100 is you have to survive, you know, getting some really bad
No, you're right.
And bad assignments.
The good thing is, whenever... All right, so remember in Batman, the when he shoots... Remember the goon that when the Joker shoots, like, Bill the thug? Remember, he takes his gun and shoots him.
Yes.
He was, like, the number one henchman. So when the number one henchman fails, the bad villain always shoots him for some reason. It's never number 100 villain. Does that make sense? So if you're on a mission, and I'm on a snowmobile, right, and everything goes to crap, I would just wipe out my snowmobile, and I would kind of lay there for a little while. It all fails, we all go back, the number one henchman gets shot. 10 other henchmen have gone down, I've moved from 100 to 78 on my first day on the job.
Yeah, yeah. So, I've always been bothered by that scene, and you're talking about the Michael Keaton Batman, yeah, when he comes off the float and shoots his number one guy. Yeah, like, he had... I mean, I understand being a psychopath and a sociopath, but even at that, like, what did this guy's been nothing but loyal, and he just, like, takes him out.
And it's still a business. Yeah. Like, you want your number one guys around.
And there's no, you can talk to any HR person in the world, there is no greater cost than employee turnover. I mean, that is the single biggest cost to an organization, is retraining new people. And I feel like that's where master villains fail in that understanding, and is that just from an organizational standpoint, they're too impulsive, and that's ultimately why they fail.
I would stay in the 10 to 20 to 10 range as a henchman. That's my goal. Like, I want to be Rick.
You can make a nice living.
Rick all the time. Just nice carry living, bodies
but
away.
But no blame.
Yep, exactly. And so, like, I would always kind of let, if we're on a mission, I'd let the number 21 guy do better than me. So then I'd be like, okay, well, he leapfrogged you. That's fine. You know, like, hey, Rick's been number 17 for 12 years. 17 gets on the helicopter at the end. Right. Or they get on the bus that's behind the thing.
Right.
I got a good plan. I could be a good henchman. Also, listen to our podcast about henchmen. It's a really good one. I think we just broke that down. All right, next question. If you could work for any Bond villain, be a henchman for any Bond villain, which henchman would you want to work for?
Wow, that's a good question.
I got a good answer. You want to hear it? Or do you want to go first?
You know what? Because, you know, as another podcast I listen to, when anyone says that's a really good question, that is just like buying time to think. So why don't you go first?
Yeah.
I don't want it to skew it, but it will. But I'm thinking. But go ahead.
Also, people go, absolutely.
Yeah. Wow.
Think. Yeah. Think. Okay, yeah, yeah.
I'm buying time, so go ahead.
All right, From Russia with Love.
Okay.
All right, Spectre.
Yeah.
Red Grant. He probably worked his way up, but he was allowed to work his way up. And he was given a decent amount of freedom, I feel like, in his role. He was a henchman. He was an assassin, but he was still a henchman, right? So I feel like Spectre allowed their employees to kind of flourish. And they trusted him in the beginning because he killed the Bond in, what, a minute and 46 seconds? Something
right,
like that.
Right.
So they train you really well. They put you through testing phases. They buy, if they like you, it's like they're putting you through assassin college.
Right.
And then when you're sent on a mission, you kind of have to succeed, but you're also kind of allowed to, you're not being micromanaged, I don't feel like. You're probably allowed to be out there and fail on your own, right? So when you do fail, you're not like, well, it's because of you guys. It's like, I fail because Bond bested me. So I kind of like that. I don't want to work for Dominic Green in here. He takes his best buddy, Elvis, the neck brace henchman.
I know. Just simply brilliant.
Puts a gun up and just has him get blown up. He blows it, kills geologists. Right. He doesn't care about his henchmen. You watch all these movies and layers, they all get blown up. But, like, I want to work for that. They train you. They're not going to let you blow up in a lab if they've been training you for 6 years. So, like, that's what I would work for Spectre and From Russia with Love.
Okay. I'm going to take a different tact with you on this one. I think I'd like to be a henchman. And when I say this, I think that some people are going to applaud my out-of-the-box thinking here. I'd like to work for Octopussy.
How come?
I would be on an island of only women.
Yep.
Enough said.
Yeah. What would be your henchman job? Security?
Security.
Yeah?
Security. I mean, and you don't even have to be good at it, because in Octopussy, you know, they put Bond in a room, and then because it's like one of those, like, very old, you know, structures built years ago, there's no, like, glass in the window. You know, the guy's just, you know, Bond just hops out the window and he's walking on the side and everything like that. And no one seems to, you know, get fired. But the idea being is, if there's five henchmen on that island doing security and there's like 90 women.
Yeah.
Your odds are pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm just saying.
Are you signing contracts before? Like what's the things?
That's a good question, because technically it was supposed to be a pure pure island for women.
So this is like a Wicker Man scenario where the men are just sort of they do all the work.
But come on, we're talking about women in their young 20s. I mean, is paperwork really gonna get in the way of that? And if you're the only guy and they can't go anywhere, they're not allowed to leave the island. You're kind of like
you're playing the odds.
There you go.
That's interesting. So you wouldn't get fired for doing a bad job either.
No. No, I'm looking at it from a completely different point of view.
Yeah, got it.
I'm trying to be a little
cheeky.
Yeah, but if I was trying to think of something a little fun for the podcast, but
you could be surfing, you could be hanging out.
Think about it.
Do you have weekends off?
Now that you got to live in India, so that's not that's probably not the ideal situation either. But if you're gonna ask me in terms of the world that Bond creates.
That's where you go.
That wouldn't be a bad one, man.
Who would be the worst one to work for?
The worst one? Oh, I think it'd be easily Silva. From Skyfall, yeah. You know, that dude just
he killed that poor lady, and then what Bond's like, you wasted scotch. Like, Silva, man, he didn't care about henchmen.
No.
I don't think he would even put up henchmen in a nice place.
No, that's even the bigger question is, like, when you see certain villains, like, are do these how do henchmen become henchmen? Like, what in a sense, like, at what point if you're working for Silva, are they like in the
break? How do you get in front of him?
And you're on that crazy little city island that he took over. But even more so, you're in it with a couple henchmen in the break room. Like, aren't you talking like? Dude, man, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Silva's
going to kill me.
Yeah, we're going nowhere here. There's no career advancement.
We're out of coffee.
Yeah, Silva would definitely be at the top of that list.
Robert Davi would be good, too, because if you think about Benicio Del Toro in The Living Daylights.
No, that was License to Kill.
License to Kill.
Living Daylights was in Afghanistan.
Got it. So he would be pretty good because he seemed to trust his henchmen. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Bond was able to very smartly get into that organization. Wayne Newton somehow got it to be part of that organization, and, Benicio Del Toro. Robert Davi would be a good one to work for, too.
Are you a bad guy? Yeah. Are you part of the crew? Sweet. Like, here's a suit. Awesome.
Yeah. What's great about Davi, man, is that what I love is villains that don't really perceive themselves as villains. Like, Robert Davi is like just kind of like the head of the mob in Isthmus City for all intents and purposes, and the bank was just the government controlled bank was really just his ability to launder money.
Yeah.
And he just viewed it as, a business.
Yeah.
Like a cartel owner or something to that effect. Like, I'm not doing anything right or wrong. I'm providing services, products for the people. So I always loved Robert Davi in that movie because he never viewed himself as good or bad. He just viewed himself as a guy, that was selling a product and violence was part of his career. Little known fact, did you know Robert Davi, first Bond villain ever to wear pink in a Bond movie?
That's pretty interesting.
You're welcome. That is true.
I like that a lot.
He wore a pink button down.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You figured Walken would have been that one.
You would think. There's some other ones that you think could have done that, but yep.
The location was where?
Technically Isthmus City, but he wore that's when Bond woke up at his house.
He had pink on?
And let me tell you something. If you want to go down into Bond villain homes, Robert Davi is definitely in the top three. That was one of the all-time great pads.
I mean, I'm switching this as just like a violent henchman role.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could chill. Like, he, if you fail, he's not going to shoot you. You're not in a volcano. You're not, I mean, you have good odds in India on this beach with these women, but you're also, you're probably not looked at real well. You're probably just playing the odds. Like, probably pretty boring out there. But here, you're kind of trusted.
And you're trusted. And you think about it, outside of Bond coming into Isthmus City, for all intents and purposes, he ran that country. So you're a henchman, but no one's messing with you.
Yeah, exactly. No one's going to look at you and go, you're just a henchman.
Right. You're working for the most powerful guy. And you're probably almost never going to be put in a position where you're going to die. Because you're always in the most powerful position, unless Bond comes to town.
And kills everyone else, and it's just down to the three of you.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm going to send my other henchmen on a jet ski chase. I'm not going to be on this. Because I'm too trusted to be wasted in a jet ski chase.
Right. You know, so... But, yeah, I mean, Living Daylights is another one that gets kind of marked down, and I think that's truly one that should be at the... in the top 10. I think the Living Daylights is the whole Florida Keys sequence where he wraps the Cessna with Robert Davi in it and like hooks it. Then they parachute to Felix Leiter's wedding.
That's cool.
You know, that's the, and then the shark eating scene of Felix Leiter is in that movie. That's a very underrated movie.
Was that like, why was Dalton was like though, these movies had solid reviews.
Yes, you know, and that was, they had, you know, the Rock of Gibraltar is where the, you know, it started. The problem I think that people had was Dalton, who was considered to be an earlier Bond when Roger Moore was kind of thinking about calling it quits. I think...
Moore's book is good, by the way.
Yeah, Dalton...
He was different. He was kind of smiley. He had a different... He wasn't...
He really tried to be the... He's the only one that really came close to the book version of Bond.
Oh, wow.
I would say. And that Connery... Connery tried to be that Bond, but some people have the it factor to them. Connery does. And he just was so magnetic a personality that he just... took over, like, whatever Bond was in the book, this guy is 10 times better. I want to be that guy. Dalton was almost like an everyman. Great actor, but he was almost like an everyman kind of Bond, and I think that Roger
they
Moore...
They don't want that.
Yeah, Connery and Moore were larger-than-life types of characters. Dalton wasn't. And then you come back with Brosnan, who was this larger...
Yeah, suave. Oh, and then Craig.
Craig, yeah. I mean, you have to have... That's why, you know, when people always ask me about... How would I have felt about Idris Elba being Bond? And, you know, people get into this, oh, you know, Bond's a, you know, a white guy, this, that, and the other. And I go, I understand that. But I go...
He has it.
He has... Whatever it is, Idris Elba has whatever Daniel Craig has, whatever Pierce Brosnan has. You're not looking at a African-American actor. You're just looking at a brilliant dude on screen. To me, it's colorblind.
I'd have been all for it.
Yeah, and if you can find the right African-American, or even to some extent the right woman, like, I'd be interested in
it. People are looking at Henry Golding now from Crazy Rich Asians and Simple Favor. Like, people are throwing those names. Like, but I think if you're right, if you have that, if you're just, if they're good, they're good.
They're good. I you know, obviously, I think Elba's window has passed. I think he's
in his 50s, maybe. Right?
He's a little older, but he still gets the question, which I think he you know,
he plays it up. He plays it up.
Yeah, I mean, he just got named People's Sexiest Man of the Year. But
nice.
I think it would have been, if the windows were different, I think Elba would have really transcended the role and done a lot of good.
Because he has a physicality.
Oh, yeah.
He has the line readings. I mean,
like, and he's got the you gotta, men want to have to be you, women want to be with you. Yep. You know, you have to have that. And I don't know if Dalton, I think that was his one, I don't think women, when they saw Timothy Dalton, were just like compelled, like, oh my God, like a Connery or Moore. Craig, Brosnan especially.
It's funny you say this, because I was teaching my class about the 60s, and I was teaching about the 10 most influential films of the 1960s. That's another one of our podcasts. You should listen to it. But I was talking about Dr. No, and a man, like, so he was one of the first characters who shot and killed. Like, so the guy pulled the gun on him, like, how many bullets do you have left? And he just wastes the guy, even though he has none. And they was in all these locations, and so, like, women were like, I love Sean Connery, but guys were like, because during the 60s, there was, like, the everyman hero. You know, he had, you know, like High Noons, like in the 50s, and those kind of films.
Yeah, the anti-heroes almost.
And then you have, you know, just like the good, charming Western heroes and those kind of people. But then here's Bond, all rakish and suave and like betting money and like betting women and shooting people and like in cold blood because he had a license to kill. That was a new type of character and people fell in love with that. So it's pretty interesting that you say that, because that's in the 60s. That was what blew him up, is because of that character was like that.
Everything comes down to casting that singular character. And you have to give the Broccolis credit. You know, they took a...
Blonde Bond.
Took a chance on Daniel Craig, and it's kind of funny now. It's going to be interesting to see in Bond 26 who they do select. Because, you know, the pressure's going to be on, because they they really raised the bar and took a risk with Craig, and it worked in an unbelievable way.
I want Tom Hardy. It'd be a weird Bond, but it would be more like a Dalton Bond. But also, you know what people are saying now? Richard Madden. He was on a show called The Bodyguard on Netflix. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I've heard of it, yes.
Got nominated for a bunch of Golden Globes. But now, after that show came out, he went to number one. The bookies have that you can take bets. And he's number one to be Bond now. Richard Madden.
That's interesting.
So I guess I want to watch that Bodyguard because he's number one right now. Because that show is like 98% Rotten Tomatoes. Huge. Like my mom sent me a message. Oh my gosh, it's amazing. She doesn't speak like that. My mom speaks like this. But so that's what they're saying it is now.
You know, it's funny that movie, the show, The Bodyguard. The reason I was initially like, it's like anything without any information, you can make bad decisions. I wasn't initially interested in it because I thought it was like some sort of Kevin Costner, Whitney Houston, some sort of like continuance. And I was like, I had no interest in that movie, much less anything that would be a continuance of it. Literally making a decision with zero information at my disposal other than the title of the show.
I didn't even know what it was about, but I guess it's about a guy who is working with he was a former soldier, is working with a woman who's kind of anti, like she's more liberal and he was like a soldier, so they're completely different, but he has to protect her, and then things go crazy, then he has to go like full suave Bond and like save the day. So they're saying that's who's it. So let's get back to Quantum of Solace here. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on with this movie? Is there anything that you kind of wanted to get out in regards to this film? I thought that general was gross. I guess he did his job, the Bolivian general. Mm-hmm. The whole scene where he told that waitress to go into a room so he could just do horrible, like, and then the whole fight, like that. I don't know, man. Am I becoming too sensitive? Because I felt that scene was just kind of gross.
It's what made it even more gross is that the hotel is like seemingly empty and she's like the only female in the building.
Yeah,
which made it even like feel even more disturbing. And I think what makes it even more disturbing is what if Bond didn't show up that day?
Horrible.
Yeah, so you're not wrong. It's definitely like as soon as you see her, as soon as he says bring my drink to my room.
Yeah.
It's cringy.
And like the whole, like, you know, Trevelyan, well, this is just a side guy, but like 006 never really did that. Like just, maybe that's good that he just felt gross, but I just never felt.
Well, even in Skyfall, the woman who, you know, her name is escaping me, but she was the one that got
the shot, the McCallum.
She has a short role in the film. She was clearly, and Bond even speaks to it, in the sex trade.
Yeah.
But they didn't, it was heartfelt and sad, whereas in Quantum of Solace, it was cringy.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure the producers and the directors will argue that's what they wanted.
Yeah, they wanted him to be the villain.
Yeah, they wanted him to be just this, you know, completely abhorrent animal person. When you only have so many scenes.
I guess that Olga saves her. So then that's kind of like a retribution because she couldn't save her family.
Right. So, you know, maybe there's some...
I guess that makes sense when you put it in that context. Right. But what... And then also, what did you think about Gemma Arterton's role, Strawberry Fields?
I hate the name. I felt like for a movie that was trying to be truly serious, and that was a, like, a nod to... Just her name itself was a nod to, like, Bonds in the past.
Yeah.
And I felt it was very out of place.
And then he walks into the room and she just immediately like falls for him. And like that, if he's so depressed and then just like, whatever, he's Bond. He has to, you know, he's seen the SNL sketches about his STD test, but, I guess you have to have that scene, but it just felt like a throwaway role for her character.
It did.
Like she's plucky cause she trips people, but then she gets murdered.
I'm not going to lie to you. The scene where she tries to go into the hotel, and Bond is like, we're not staying here. She's like, oh, this fits our cover. We're teachers on holiday. And then they go to this, like, you know, whatever the Ritz-Carlton is of Bolivia. He pulls in there, and he goes, hi, we're teachers on holiday that just won the lottery.
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt that was kind of like, that was like a cool Bond moment in the movie for him.
That shows some personality.
Yeah. Like, you know, he was just like, I guess why I loved it is, wherever Bond got in his mental capacity, he still had standards.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm not staying in this.
I am not staying here.
I think they didn't need that role, though. They could have brought in Olga from... Maybe Olga ends up there again, like, sooner.
Right.
Like, they could have not focused less on her and then brought in Olga. I mean, I know I keep saying Olga Kirilenko, but that could have been, yeah.
Here's what I think may have happened. Bond needed to bed a woman. And the way, and it wasn't going to be Camille, because that would have made no sense whatsoever.
None.
So.
We just need to hit this.
What do we do?
Yeah.
So I feel like that's what it was.
I guess that goes back to our whole thing with, like, I want a fight scene in Air, Wind, and Fire. And then we found this great location. Let's just do something there.
Right.
Like, they were kind of ticking off certain things for the Bond film. Does that make sense?
Look, I mean, I would imagine this, you know, being assigned a Bond movie is a director's
dream.
Yeah. And so
Daniel Craig wanted Mark Forster because he loved his prior work.
Right. So, and look, I mean, Sam Mendes did. You mean, who thought Sam Mendes
American
was...
Beauty guy does
yeah,
it.
Yeah, like, was going to pull off Skyfall. So you sometimes never know. And then sometimes, and look, you know, sometimes, you know, people are always like, well, why don't you get, like, Brad Bird to do a Bond or whatever the case may be? But it's like, okay, but he works with Tom Cruise and the Mission Impossible series. Like, just... some of these things aren't transferable. Just because you do other great action series doesn't mean you'd be great for Bond. But Bond is different. Bond... Look, we're having a 90-minute conversation on Bond. I don't know. Maybe one day there'll be a 90-minute pod on the Mission Impossible series. Maybe. But... as great as those movies are, especially the last three, I mean, they are iconic action films. Mm-hmm. They still don't capture the imagination like Bond. Even though Ethan Hunt is Ethan Hunt, and they've built a franchise, arguably some of the movies are you know, better than Bond movies. Bond has this certain cultural reference, like Mickey Mouse.
People expect it to be something, and they care about who gets cast. Mission Impossible, it's a great popcorn film. Oh, let's go there for the stunts. And let's I mean, this latest one's a masterpiece, but and we both own it, but I would rather talk about Bond movies than Mission Impossible movies.
Right? Yeah.
Because with Bond, Mission Impossible, they're great. I think they've almost been too good. With these have flaws to them, so they're balanced well. So you can kind of chat about the significance, 50 years worth of them.
And we want Bond, you know, I don't need Ethan Hunt to have depth. I don't need him to have a story arc. I need him to be Ethan Hunt.
Yeah.
Bond, we're getting into this conversation about Quantum of Solace, where we're getting into... like, his mental state in the movie. Like, what other franchise? I mean, you don't even do that in Star Wars.
Nope. And, you know, there's a big thing about it. This is the first time he gets tanked in a movie.
Yeah.
Six Vespers. Yeah, or seven on the plane.
Yep.
That was a big deal. He got drunk. You know, a report just came out saying that he's a severe alcoholic.
Well, this always gets back to, like, there's always moments in all the Bond movies that you could pluck out and go, well, you know what, that was good. And Die Another Day, when they finally do the prisoner exchange and he's in the hospital and he's kind of sitting there laying and they got all the everything in the hospital room and you can hear the guy over the speaker going through, like, oh, heart's good, this good, you know, this good. And then the guy goes, liver's not so good. I always feel like that was a great line.
Yeah.
After he's like going through all his vitals and they're going, liver's not so good though.
Funny. That's a good scene though. Craig pulls, I wish there was more scenes with Craig where he was being drunk or when that line where teachers who are millionaires. Cause I thought he excelled at that in Casino Royale.
Look, I think the best part of Skyfall is right after the opening credit scenes when he is, you know, pretending to be dead.
Yeah.
And he's got a Heineken, and he's clearly, they don't show him drunk, but he's in a bar, and he's throwing down shots
McCallum.
For money.
Yep.
McCallum with the scorpion. Like, I feel like we got shortchanged a little bit on that sequence when he was lost. I was like, this is interesting.
Yeah. Give me more of this.
I was like, I will even admit to you, when I've watched Skyfall, I've actually stopped and gone back and just watched it again, just because it's so fascinating. You never see Bond like that. I mean, even in License to Kill, yes, he loses his license, but he's still Bond. Like, okay, we're taking your license back, but then it's like...
shoot.
Okay, it's a piece of paper and no one does anything yeah. about it, right? He still gets to do whatever the hell he wants. That's such a great scene of him just like drinking, and he wakes up he's still in the bar the next day and he's still drinking out of the bottle and, you know, everything like that. And then it's like too quick.
Yeah.
And then you see him when he finally shows up at M's apartment and he just looks sunken in and his eyes. And then she has that great line. We sold your flat. He goes, well, I'll get a hotel. Well, you're bloody not staying here. Yeah. You know, so.
Yeah, no. Yeah, absolutely. But I guess, yeah, there just weren't enough of those moments. I would have liked to have seen Bond in a neck brace in this movie.
Well, the fact that, is this the first Bond movie where a neck brace comes out?
Probably.
Yeah.
By a henchman.
Yeah.
A number one henchman.
Right.
That's why working with Dominic Green would be horrible.
But he showed some level of care for his henchman by allowing him to get medical attention.
And he probably had a day off.
You know, wearing a neck brace, you know, even to go to a big meeting with the dictator. I mean,
that could look bad.
I know.
No, does Spectre, knowing what you know about Spectre, make this movie better or worse?
Quantum of Solace?
Yeah.
Like I said, I think I enjoyed Spectre. I feel like Quantum of Solace is a very solid story with very little plot holes. I feel like the issue with Quantum of Solace is they just missed tying it together.
Yeah.
Spectre has some pretty gaping plot holes that when I watch it, it's better shot. It feels more like a Bond movie. But, you know, like the Star Trek movie, it really missed on the whole Blofeld reveal at the end, just kind of like it did with the Khan reveal with, you know, Fassbender in the Star Trek movie.
Everyone knew he was Blofeld. But I guess in regards, there's a scene.
I feel Quantum of Solace looks better as a movie. But if you're just talking about entertaining, there's no question. I would not. Spectre is a more enjoyable movie to sit down and let's all kick back and watch a movie. You know, it's Quantum of Solace is like kicking back and let's watch Ordinary People. You know, let's watch Terms of Endearment. That's what it is. I think that's a fair point. Quantum of Solace is the series, you know, Terms of Endearment. It really is when you think about it.
Do you think it made sense though when they're like, how can they be everywhere? Remember when Judi Dench asked that? And then you learn it's Spectre. Did that clarify things for you a little bit? Because they kind of dropped that theme. Remember that? She's like, how can they be everywhere? And then he just goes to Haiti.
Because
then I guess they
Well, when he goes to Tosca. And
oh,
then,
yeah.
You know,
all those people are there.
They're all there. And that's they kind of have meetings in public.
I'd hate to sit next to those guys. You're trying to watch an opera.
Well, you think how smart Mr. White was. He was the only one that stayed in his seat.
Yeah.
He didn't give himself up in that movie. Everyone else stood up to get out of there. Mr. White.
Stayed.
Yeah.
Huh. I need to watch Spectre again now because I like him in that. That's a good point. All right. Well, that was good. Never mind. All right. Anything else? I think we've covered most of this movie, right?
Yeah, I think we did it. I hope that people will give it another shot. Come at it with what you've learned from this podcast and kind of watch it with a new sensibility and realize that it's a very good entry of the 24. I don't think even in 20 years it's going to have a Majesty Secret Service revival and be in the top 10, but I think that it will
have a decline.
I think it'll improve in people's minds as time goes on, because I think our movie watching sensibilities are really grounded in this new fangled, even with Marvel movies, you know, we'll accept a lot of things, but we need it to be grounded in some sort of sensibility and fact, and we want the plot to make, you know, sense. I always go back to Breaking Bad when the guys that Vince Gilligan always said, coincidences can never, ever work in the favor of the protagonist. That's my problem with Spectre.
Oh, you're here. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
that's my problem with Spectre. There's too many conveniences that work in to make it go, to get the plot to get from point A to B. That's what makes Better Call Saul, and especially Breaking Bad, none of the coincidences ever go in favor of Walter White. And I think that's the genius of Vince Gilligan. I feel like Quantum of Solace really attempts to not have any coincidences. Everything works against Bond. And that's why I think it's a pretty good movie. And it's a very, very good entry. That said, I know there's people listening today that are going to be like shaking their head going, who is your brother-in-law? And why does he like this movie?
And what does he do?
Why does he like this movie? But, you know, I would argue that go back and watch some Roger Moore. And I loved Roger Moore. That was my era. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, take a good rosy peek back at some of the Roger Moore entries. Not The Spy Who Loved Me. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Don't look at that one. For Your Eyes Only, brilliant. But go take a look at View to a Kill. Go watch, Octopussy when he swings on a vine and there's Tarzan yells in the middle of it. I mean,
and then tell us that this is number 24, right?
That's my point.
Got it.
Watch Moonraker, buddy.
I'll close out here. I'll say,
although Holly Goodhead is maybe
that's a great name.
Iconic.
Jeffrey Wright. We didn't talk about Felix Leiter.
Yes, brought him back.
I like
from...
that he brought. That's rarely happens in movies, and then.
And he gets promoted. So you see, that's where he gets promoted. And boy, did they cast his boss as
David Harbour.
Boy, what a goofball he was.
Stranger Things.
And
now he's Hellboy.
Right. But you watch that movie, you're like, how did this like, everyone in, like, MI6 is, like, so competent. And then the first time you see, like, the American side in a Daniel Craig movie, it's like, nepotism. Yeah. Or how did this guy get his job?
And then the last thing is henchmen take gift bags when they're at concerts. I just want you to know that. They love their free gift bags. Because there's that scene in the movie when they grab gift bags. I know it, stuff was in them, but I just like the idea of henchmen taking free.
I think swag.
Elvis.
I think swag is important because it's probably
a,
it's probably the way to, you know, keep their salaries down.
Yeah, free swag that you can sell because there's some good watches that you can get from good swag.
Yeah, and then you know, you have to even wonder, like, do henchmen get to keep, like, the watches, wallets of people that they kill? Is that part of their compensation package? Like, you get to kind of sell whatever you take off a, you know, one of your dead bodies or people that you interrogate.
I think 100 through 51 can. But once you hit 50, you shouldn't have to do that anymore.
Got it.
That's only a few weeks. But in the first few weeks, you can take whatever you want. But when you get promoted, then that's when the healthcare kicks in and stuff.
Right, yeah. Maybe there's some more paperwork with HR.
You need to survive 2 ski chases, 1 snowmobile chase, 1 motorcycle chase.
Air chase.
1 air chase, 1 doom buggy chase, and 3 separate car chases on any different kind of terrain.
Right.
Right. And you can't be 10 through 1 unless you survived an ice chase followed by a tsunami.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. There are clear rules in the advancement of henchmen in the movie industry.
3 bullet wounds, then you can get in the top 3.
You would hope that 3 bullet wounds and you survive in defense of your boss would get you some love.
And I mean, the problem is in these movies, Bond never misses.
Yeah, I know.
So I would have to pick one up during like a fight with the CIA, like Felix Leiter's buddy. You know,
right,
skins my arm.
I
got one.
Right, yeah, he's not hitting anybody. And, you know, it's going to be by accident that he hits somebody.
All right, well, hey, thank you for joining us. We'll have you back to do another Bond movie or another movie. I'm not going to pigeonhole you into Bonds.
No. I love my Bond.
We could do Majesty's Secret Service.
Brilliant.
Oh, my gosh. That's a long one. There's a lot to talk about on that one.
I would encourage the audience to watch Quantum of Solace. That's actually a good back-to-backer because that is just as tragic.
Because you have a very long one followed by a very short one.
Right. But they're both equally...
They're gut punches.
Yeah.
Got it. All right. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Sean Elvishire, this is Movies, Films, and Flakes. We'll see you next week.